You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 604. To make a fine film, you need three things: a great script, and a great script. Alfred Hitchcock.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Film Convert Nitrate. Now, guys, I've been in post-production for close to 30 years, and I have never seen a plug-in for film conversion better than Film Convert Nitrate. It allows you to color correct and add just the right amount of film grain, film look to your projects. I've used Film Convert on my projects, like on my last feature film, On the Corner of Ego and Desire, and so many other projects over the years. Film Convert realistically models the amount of grain required in each color and exposure level in your image. It is remarkable. Now, the plugins available for Premiere Pro, DaVinci Resolve, and Final Cut Pro. And if you want to get 10% off your purchase, all you got to do is go to filmconvert.com and use the coupon code IFH. That's filmconvert.com, coupon code IFH. Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, have you ever wanted to write a screenplay super fast? Well, then this is the episode for you. We have on the show returning champion, Jeff Ballo. And Jeff is the creator of the fast screenplay method. And Jeff is one of the most downloaded episodes in the history of the show. He was back years ago on the show, and I wanted to bring him back because his method is something I really hadn't seen before in the way he approaches everything. And we had a fantastic conversation, as we always do. Jeff is a wealth of information in regards to story, structure, and how to get that script onto the page fast and effectively. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jeff Ballo. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion, Jeff Ballo. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm great, Alex. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Thanks for coming back on the show, brother.
Thanks for having me, man. It's been a while.
It's been a few minutes. Yeah. I think you were in the hundreds, if I remember correctly.
I think it was like right around 100. Yeah.
Yeah, in the hundreds or something like that when you came on last time. But your episode is one of the more downloaded episodes in the history of the show. It's always done very, very well. So I was thinking the other day, I'm like, you know what? I think get Jeff back on the show. I think we need to introduce what you do to the audience, to this, you know, new audience
that wasn't around.
To a new generation, yeah. Sir. That's how old exactly. We are.
Exactly.
To the new members of the tribe that have been listening. And I've gathered since last we spoke, which is, you know, substantial since then.
Exactly.
So I wanted to introduce
by leaps and bounds.
Yeah. So I wanted to introduce what you do and who you are to the tribe. So for people who didn't listen to the first episode, how did you and why did you want to get into this insanity that is the film industry?
Well, so I was insane as a very young child. I literally cannot remember a time when I didn't want to be in the film industry. And so when I was like 5 or 6, 7, somewhere around there, I was like constantly dreaming characters for myself on my favorite TV shows. So like at the time, dating myself a little bit here, like it was Cheers was one of my big shows that I would like. I would imagine character for myself as Sam Malone's long lost kid, because, you know, he used to like sleep around and all that kind of stuff. So what if he didn't know that he had a kid? And I would like literally dream up a whole episode of me appearing and being the guest star of like, hey, I didn't know. I didn't, and I would imagine the whole show. So it was a weird like acting slash writing fantasy that I had as this kid. So, you know, I'd be on my paper route throwing papers and dreaming up various fantasies on all these different shows. By the time I got to be 12 years old, I was like, my life is slipping away from me. So I said, I gotta do something about this. And there was a guy at my local church who had a recurring role on a soap opera called Santa Barbara. And so, of course, to me, he was an A-lister.
Obviously,
he was probably a guy like just that was one of his few gigs that year. But to me, he was an A-list. He had the golden keys to the kingdom. So I asked him, how do you get into this? And he told me, here's where you go to it was Dramalogue back in the day. Here's where you go for casting notices and try to take a picture of yourself and get an agent. And I got an agent. I was with a kids agency who at the time represented like Will Wheaton and Mayim Bialik and that kind of stuff. And got some gigs here and there and just fell in love with the whole process once I was actually in it and on camera and doing the child acting thing. And once you fall in love with the process, it's really hard to, you know, to forget that you fell in love with the process. So you're just like, I became a sponge and I just did, you know, you name it. So I don't know how far down that road you want me to go, but fair that enough. Was the genesis.
So then was there any films or TV shows that we might recommend? Remember you from, sir?
I mean, the only one that people remember today is I had a bit part in a movie called Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, where I got stoned with Christina Applegate's brother.
Fair enough. Hey.
Okay. Oh, and I said to a future X-Files star, David Duchovny, park it yourself, Metallica breath. To which I begged and pleaded with the director, don't make me say this line. It's the stupidest line in the world. And when we had the cast and crew screening, it got the biggest laugh of the entire show.
Metallica
for the breath. Stupidity of the line. So Metallica breath. Yeah,
that's
we were like headbanger guys. I know.
I don't understand.
I don't either. It does not make any sense, but it was a thing for a while there.
That is a cult film, everyone.
Cult, yes.
It's cult is a good word. I remember seeing it in the theater. That's how old I am.
Yeah, me too. That's how old I
am. And Christina Applegate was a huge star. She was still Married with Children at the time.
It was her first, sort of foray, her first big move into movies. It wasn't her first movie, but it was her first big move into movies.
Can you imagine if a movie today was called Don't Tell Mom?
Well, funny enough, it was not called that originally. When we shot it, it was called The Real World. And then as it was being edited, The Real World, the MTV first reality show, came along and they went, oh, we have to change the title. So literally we're at the cast and crew screening and they go, oh, by the way, we've changed the title. And we asked the producer's kids and they thought it would be funny to call it Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. And we all went, oh God.
I'll tell you what, that name is the thing that's the thing that sticks.
I honestly think that that's the only reason we still remember it today. I mean, it's a cute movie, but it's like you only remember it for the title, which is a good lesson for would-be screenwriters and creative people. Like if you're making a comedy, make sure your title's funny. If you're making a horror film, make sure your title is scary, you know?
Right. So, exactly. And you know, Weekend at Bernie's and things like that.
Exactly.
How that movie ever got made is beyond me. And that's such an 80s movie.
I love
movie.
That it did though. Oh,
and not only one, but two.
Of course.
Because the body obviously doesn't stink after the first movie.
I was going to say like how long later was Bernie's two? I can't remember now. 2 years later, there's Bernie still.
Whoops. The 80s.
Oh, seriously. It's so funny. So much of the 80s, I was thinking about this the other day, so much of the films from that generation don't.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Kind of hold up today. There's
no,
a lot of cringy.
And a lot of those movies in the 80s live beautifully in my memory. And I don't want to watch them again because like I saw a scene from Bloodsport.
Okay.
And I was like, no, I'm not going to watch it. No. In my mind, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. In my mind, the action sequences were great. And some scenes are great. The action sequences and stuff are really fun to watch. But I don't need to see the story of that. No. It's perfect here. It's right.
Exactly.
Most Von Damme films from the 80s and 90s were, it's good right here.
I mean, there's a lot of like John Hughes stuff that you're like,
oh, no. 16 Candles.
I loved that movie as a kid. And now, like, oh, I don't even think I'd be able to sit through it.
Some of them, some of them. But we all watch Home Alone at Christmas.
And it's just funny how just time changes and our cultural sensibilities shift. And as they do, a lot of the things that we look back on that seemed relatively normal and tame culturally back in the day just kind of, they don't necessarily seem that way today. So I, in some ways, it's kind of encouraging because it means there's always going to be this need for new, fresh voices and new, fresh ideas and perspectives and stories. What we need to do then is tell those stories in a way that gives the today audience the same feel that we had back in the day with movies are of the time, of the moment. You look back at 50s and 60s films and the sensibilities were different in those times. So some of those things can transcend and hang on over the years, but some of them are really relegated to the era in which they were made.
Yeah, I mean, you can watch Die Hard and it still holds. Yeah. You can watch Wizard of Oz and it still holds. You can watch Godfather and it still holds. These things transcend time and space. Pacing might be a little bit slower than we're used to and things like
that. Yes, definitely.
But overall they still, I mean, I still watch Casablanca and I'm just like, oh God, it's just so.
But how much of it is because you already have that bond with it versus.
Correct. Oh, if it was fresh, you would be like.
Be like, well, sure. Does this make sense here?
I mean, but you look at something like Shawshank and you know,
I agree.
It's going to hold from, I mean, look, there might be a time where if it doesn't cut every 5 seconds. Or every 2 seconds, it's not going to work.
I think one of the challenges we have today is, you know, so many people are watching YouTube and whatever at like double speed that then to dial it back into the, you can't watch a movie at double speed. You're going to miss, like, you're going to get info. You're going to get data points. You're going to get plot twists and turns, but you're not going to get nuance and feeling and the emotional subtlety. So you can't really watch a movie and take everything that the movie's giving you away at double speed. So that's going to force the normal speed to be faster. That's one of the reasons why we want cuts every so often now, I think. And it's like, where does that end? How does that change the story medium over time? I just find that a fascinating sort of puzzle, you know?
So let's bring it back to what you've been doing now for a few years,
yes.
Which is helping screenwriters with screenwriting development. So the first question, we're going to talk about the fast screenplay, which is a fantastic system that you've come up with. The first question is, what are the three fundamental problems with screenplay development?
Well, so we have a bunch of fundamental problems, but sort of some core fundamental problems are that at the end of the day, we're making a film. When you're writing a screenplay, you're not writing it for the end reader. You're writing it for the audience. You're writing it for the people who are going to make the film for an audience. So because we're not writing for the reader, a lot of writers often get into this place where they think my work has to be perfect, or how I see it in my head is what it has to be. And it, there's this there's this delicacy that they treat it with that doesn't really hold in how the industry works. The screenplay is a blueprint for the production process. The screenplay is the thing around which we all huddle and decide that this is the movie we're going to make. It's not the screenplay. It's not the, as the writer, the idea in your head is not the thing that's going to end up on the screen. The idea in your head is what informs the ideas in all these other creative people's heads, which is what's going to end up on the screen, right? So fundamentally, a challenge that we have is that we have to create for a creative team, right? We also have to, another fundamental challenge is that there is not the money, particularly in the indie film world, to pay for that script development. So if there's not that money to pay for that script development, how do we develop projects? So let's say you've written a script, you send it to me as a producer looking for material. I look over that script and I say, hey, this is a great idea. This is a decent story, but it falls apart in the second act and it doesn't really work. And I need to change and my lead is a little bit older than this. Can we age it up a little bit? Like, I have these changes I need to make. Either I'm going to have to pay you or someone who's skilled at doing that to fix that project, money which I can't guarantee is going to give me the result that I want, and money which I can't recoup if I don't make this film. So it's very risky for the producer to say, I'm going to go ahead and buy this or make this. So as a result, we don't, and we say no. And it's much more, you're much more likely to get a no because there's too much required on the producer's side to go down that road. So as a result, what the producer needs is for the writer to be at a higher level of development. Like, they need the project to come in, at least on the indie level where you don't have the money for development. They need the script and the project to come in at a higher caliber, at a higher state of readiness with less, what I call a viable production ready screenplay. You need that in order to be able to say yes, so that I can at least see that if there are some adjustments, they're minor, and this writer is talented enough, they can probably make those adjustments. That is one of the fundamental problems. So those are the main kind of big sticking points. Now, fundamentally within the industry, my belief is that one of the grand challenges we have is that most screenwriting is taught by writers. And by being taught by writers, what you often don't get is the producer's perspective. So you often don't get what the producer needs in your project. So if you're writing something and you don't understand what the producer actually needs in your project, what they need from a packaging standpoint, what they need from a logistics and production standpoint, what they need from a budgeting standpoint, you have a great idea, fantastic, but it's got a niche audience, but your budget is like this. Like, there's a mismatch there. It's misaligned. So because it's misaligned, it's always going to be a no, no matter how good that idea is. And I think part of the problem is that generally within the industry, there is not this infusion of the producer's perspective and what an understanding of that is and what that means for your project. So I don't know if that answers your questions, but
it answers exactly what it is. And I agree with you. There's so many screenwriters just come up with an idea and a story and they don't think about the end product. They don't think about how this is actually going to get produced. I have so many screenwriters that have come to me and they're like, I have this tent pole. I'm like, stop right there. Stop.
Yes, exactly. I agree.
Stop. No one is going to give you $200 million. No one's going to give you $100 million. No one's going to give you $50 million. It is not the world we live in today. No one's buying tentpole specs anymore.
It's possible, but it's the very peak of a very specific mountain that you have to climb up to qualify for. If you're writing a tentpole project, you're competing with other writers who have already written tentpole projects. They know the people. They know the pitfalls. They know how to craft a project specifically for that. Think about a Tom Cruise movie or something like he has a very clear view of and nuanced understanding of what it takes to make a big theater film, right? That big theater experience. If you don't have that experience aiming for that, it's like, I want to play in the NBA. I want to be Michael Jordan.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But I still need to learn how to dribble. Like what? Like, no, that dude spent years and years and years and years and hours and hours and hours. But writers tend not to want to spend that time and energy.
But even if they did. So let me ask you this. In the last 20 years, how many tentpole movies have been, I need one. I don't, not that there's a small amount. I need one that you can think of off the top of your head that's $100 million plus off of an original IP that had no IP prior to that.
Oh, I can't think of a single one myself. I don't know for sure, but I would imagine if there are any, it would be in the, we count them on a single hand.
If that, if there is, because I, you
if know, there
you
is.
And I, you and I are both students of the industry. I can't remember of a movie that not a small movie that made tentpole money. There's Paranormal Activity and many of those things. Agreed. Yeah, that's fine.
Agreed.
But I'm talking about a movie that walked in with $100 million plus budget but, in the studio system off of a script that no one had ever heard of before.
In a way, it's a misunderstanding of how the industry works at that level.
Correct.
When you're thinking about tentpole movies, this is a machine. This is a business enterprise. The movie is almost like, and it's probably a little controversial, but like a product, like an afterthought to what the ancillary income would be from that, toys and
for the Disney folks, some sure, for the Warner Brothers.
When you're talking about tentpoles, you're talking about Jurassic Park or whatever, this kind of thing, you're gonna you know the McDonald's Happy Meals and all that kind of stuff, right? Like there you have to be thinking about all that stuff for it to make sense. Like, who's going to put $100 million into a movie, or these days, $250, $300 million into a movie that can't generate that kind of response? Like, I find that writers often are not thinking through the business reality of the stories and the ideas. And it's not just about genre. It's about budget. It's about marketing. It's about where the money comes from. Because I think writers often think we're going to make a movie and the box office dollars are going to come in and that's going to be our windfall. And we're going to that's not where you make your money on a movie. Like that's a leading indicator of sort of the possibility of the long tail of the income stream from a movie. But if as a writer, you're just swimming around in your story ideas, and I have this great idea for a scene or I have this great idea for a character, which is often a motivating factor to get into it. But if that's the singular drive for making that, it connotes a misunderstanding of how the industry works, which is going to be the thing that's going to make actually achieving that impossible. Because what I find is that writers quit before they actually develop the skills they need to succeed in that space, because they go into it with a misunderstanding or some wrong ideas about the realities of how it is. And they sort of keep spinning their circles in the wrong direction. You spin your circles long enough in the wrong direction, you're going to burn out. You burn out, you go, this industry, you can't succeed in this industry. This is impossible. I think today there is more opportunity to succeed as a screenwriter than ever before. The secret is stop aiming for the top of that mountain and aim at where the opportunity is down here in the niche markets, in the
television,
in the indie film realm. If television, sure, but that's also its own sort of
ecosystem.
You know, ecosystem you have to get into. You can make, at the end of the day, we have the technology today to be able to make movies literally anywhere in the world. If we have the technology to make movies anywhere in the world for budgets that are down here, we also have the technology today to reach anyone in the world. It's a simple mathematical equation to be able to create a project for a specific audience if you can figure out the pricing structure of that and whatever sort of corollary backend offers, you do the filmtrepreneur thing. If you have that understanding and that awareness, we can make small movies even that can generate an income for us.
Oh, God.
And because of that, you can develop your skill today in a way that we never were able to previously because we just didn't have that opportunity. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges for writers at the moment these days. They're not focusing on all the opportunity. They're stuck on that one sort of mythical notion.
Yeah, the lottery ticket. Call it the lottery ticket mentality. And they're thinking that someone's going to show up and like, oh, I see your $100 million temple. I'm going to give you $3 million on the spec spot on this. And we're going to go call Tom Cruise. Right. And we're going to go make this thing happen. And that's the reality of the show, the reality of the world. But there is a possibility to do something with that temple script, which a lot of screenwriters, because they're only looking at the one thing, if you really are interested in the story, let's say it's an original story, but it's just too damn expensive. It's a sci-fi epic, or there's dinosaurs running around, or whatever it is.
Right.
But you can't create IP off of that. You can write a book based off of it. You could turn it into a graphic novel. There's so many ways that you can build IP around it. So that when you go off and build IP, let's say you take a year and build IP off this, you start selling books and all this stuff. Then someone from Hollywood comes knocking like, hey, we'd love your idea. Do you have a script? And you're like, hey, I happen to have one. But you've already made money with the idea. So there's other ways to make money with a big idea like that. That's not about getting it produced. I have friends of mine who did the exact same thing. And a year or two later, the people that said no to the script came knocking. Because they wanted to produce a series,
of course,
they had IP on it, and now all of a sudden they're like, "Do you have a script?" I'm like, "Yeah, I have a script. I gave it to you 3 years ago, but we'll give it to you again."
Change the draft date.
Exactly. Change the draft date and change the title if you need to, whatever, and then you send it out again. But there are other options for screenwriters to.
For sure. And I think the great thing about screenwriting is that it is something that we were talking about this a little bit before is it's something that you can go do right now. The thing is, what I believe is you need to do it right now strategically. It's at the end of the day, we all want to just be artists. And yes, we all just want to dream movies and imagine, snap our fingers and make them. But we can do that. But we're going to be doing that at a lower budget level. And if you're writing, you have to develop skills. One of the grand challenges, even at the lower budget level, is that there is increasingly endless competition for eyeballs. So you need to have stories that are going to stand out in a crowded marketplace. You have to have stories that are going to reach a specific audience. To develop the skill of doing that well, you have to keep doing it consistently. You have to, it's like dribbling practice for a basketball player. You have to practice at it. You have to get good at it. And the idea that we can just step out of the gate because we've seen 1,000 movies and magically write a great movie is this fairy tale. At the end of the day, these are skills, the story dynamics and character arcs and how to create something actually original rather than some cookie cutter formula, and how to say something that we want to say rather than just tell a story that maybe says something other than what we intended. Like all of these nuanced abilities and skills are something that takes time to develop. And so if you're only focused on that one impossible goal, of course, you're not going to succeed at that. And I don't want that to be the takeaway, because you can succeed at it. The takeaway is stop focusing on the impossible and focus on this smorgasbord of opportunity in front of you. Use it to develop your skills. You want that maybe tentpole project as a showpiece of what I'm capable of doing. That showpiece might get you writing assignments from independent production companies who just have not been able to find product stable like me, right? So it's like, yeah, if we can find the writers that are able to do that, great. And so write your passion project, but use your passion project to build your career.
Absolutely. There's a lot of ways to skin that cat, sir.
Yes, exactly.
Lots and lots of ways. So then we've been telling everybody, you know, the problems and how we can't, you know, it's difficult to get this up. But you, sir, you have the solution, sir. You've created the key to everything, sir.
I have. It's true.
So what is the fast screenplay?
Well, okay. So fast screenplay, my challenge was this. I wanted to make, so I made a little independent film in Australia with a friend of mine. Oh, I should say, we nearly made an independent film. We spent 7 years working on it, eventually had to abandon it because of story reasons and it wasn't good enough and all this kind of stuff.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But at the time, I thought we were going to be finishing. And so I started looking for screenplays to produce. Found 300 odd screenplays, literally read every single one of them over a 6 month span, found nothing I could use. Reached out to everybody that I knew. They had ideas, they had scripts, none of it, like it was just not possible. So I thought what I need is, if we're going to take our film to Cannes or AFM or something, we need to have other projects in tow. I wanted to say, yeah, you might not like this because we made it on a shoestring, but here's three other projects. See, we have the talent, invest in us on these back in the day when you could get pre-sales and all this stuff. And so I couldn't find projects. So I said, what I need to do is I need to be able to take a writer from this idea that they have to not just a screenplay, but a screenplay an independent producer could actually say yes to. So I sat down and I said, let me reverse engineer this process. What does a writer have to do to go through this process? And as I worked it out, initially, I thought there were six phases that they had to go through. Eventually, I realized there were seven phases that they had to go through. There's four key writing phases. What I call focus, apply, strengthen, tweak. It's the acronym for FAST. Basically, the focus phase, every single person, you have an idea for a movie, you're going to have to focus that idea into a story, right? You're going to take all the different ideas you have and make a story out of them, an outline or a story plan or whatever. Then you have to apply that plan to the page, which is write a first draft, essentially. So everyone, doesn't matter if you're writing the big tent pole or you're writing the little indie thing, everyone has to go through this process. Once you have that draft, what do you have to do? You have to rewrite it. You have to strengthen it until it's a solid story, the story that you wanted to tell. That's the S in FAST. Once you have that, once you have you turn these stray ideas into an actual story, then you need to tweak it. You need to polish it. You need to ensure that the reader experience is so compelling that when someone picks up your screenplay, they tear through it. They cannot put it down. It is literally a FAST screenplay. Right? A fast read. And that's how you go from idea to final to the screenplay. Now, the problem is, great, you've written the screenplay. A screenplay does not exist for its own purpose. It only exists to be turned into a film. So you need to also connect with the producer or production company. So what I realized, there's a fundamental dynamic underneath all of it, and that is the setup payoff dynamic. And so I said, there's actually a phase at the beginning prior to all this where we set up our imagination so that what we're creating is more in sync with that ultimate target. And then we have a payoff phase where we find and connect with this project's ideal producer. And that's what I thought it was. I wrote a book called Writing Fast, How to Write Anything with Lightning Speed, that goes over these six phases of the process. But along the way, after I wrote that book, I realized there's a missing phase in there. Just because you write a screenplay doesn't mean it can connect with a producer or production company. So there is a seventh phase, which is sixth in chronological order, which is the alignment phase. And what every writer is going to have to send their work out for notes and feedback. They're going to have to decipher that notes and feedback to see if the project lands the way they want it to land so that they know who to reach out and connect with. Most people who send their work out for feedback do it entirely the wrong way. They're doing it to get validation. What do you think of my script? Do you like the scene? Do you like this character? Is this any good? Do you think I have a chance? Do I stand a chance? Please tell me. It's like that person's opinion is about as valuable as any other person's opinion. Like one person is an opinion. A group of people is a consensus. You need consensus opinion. And you need to have the skills to be able to decipher what people are saying. I didn't really like the story. Okay, why? Like, what do I need to change? Like, you need to be able to know from what they say. So when you send your work out for notes and feedback, you have to decipher that. You have to figure out what the consensus is. And it's not about validating your project. It's about making sure that your project is aligned with its target. What do you want to say? Where are you trying to reach out to? If you, so those are the seven phases basically, right? So if you have all of this and you align your project, then you know exactly where to send it. Then it's simply a matter of hooking them, pulling them in, getting them excited about reading your project. And then once they do read your project, exceeding their expectations. That's the payoff phase. So I realized that once you've been through all this, you can actually use that at the beginning to make the next project even stronger. So the system itself is iterative. So at the end of the day, you will continue to loop through this process until your project improves to the point where making a sale is inevitable. And so the problem is people don't go through that process. There's probably 200, 300 skills that you need to learn, things like character development, opposition, conflict, pace, dialogue, intention, sure. Dialogue, all that stuff. So what I've done is I've taken all of those skills and I've woven them throughout the process so that as you go step by step through that process, one day at a time, you're learning a new skill each day. And as you're simply going through this process and therefore you learn by doing. And so that's ultimately what the fast screenplay system and process is all about.
So I heard you talk about the hidden story dynamic. What is the hidden story dynamic?
The setup payoff dynamic is the hit. So the when I started thinking about the hero's journey, started thinking about three act structure, started thinking, you know, all of the different story theories are kind of variations on those things. Ultimately, what it boils down to is setup and payoff. The way I started to realize was that everything in your story is going to be either setup or payoff. Or both, where it pays off one thing and then sets up another. There's actually a fourth element, which is like a reinforcement. So you set something up, you have another thing that's reinforcing that setup so that the payoff can be bigger. But ultimately, it's setup and payoff dynamic. So like a second setup, right? So if you think in terms of everything being setup and payoff dynamic, you don't have to land on these rigid three-act structure or the hero's journey, for example, have a love-hate relationship with it. It's a wonderful archetype, but it's only applicable to maybe 40, 50% of stories, hero-driven stories. You don't need to tell hero-driven stories. You mentioned Shawshank earlier. Shawshank is not a hero-driven story. Shawshank takes the hero character and splits it into two characters, which is what I refer to as the protagonist and the main character. So the protagonist is the character whose actions dictate the twists and turns of the story. The things they do change the direction of our story. The main character is the story whose eyes we experience the story through.
Red and Andy.
Right. So Andy's the protagonist. Red is the main character. The main character is the one who changes. Right. Yeah, he's the one who Andy doesn't really change. He stays. He has some change, but not from a character arc standpoint. He has remained steadfast through the whole thing.
Yeah, Red makes a much bigger change from the beginning to the end.
But Andy, so if you were to use the hero's journey dynamic, it doesn't make sense in Shawshank.
Try to do a detective story with the hero's journey. It doesn't work.
Exactly. So my point is the hero's journey is fantastic as far as it goes. We have this sort of love affair with these things. And here's my read on it as someone who's been teaching screenwriting now for 25 freaking years, right? Is that I believe that we have the three act structure archetype. We have the hero's journey. We have the story circle. We have these kinds of different ideas because this is a ball of string that is very amorphous. There's no right or wrong in storytelling. There is only effective or ineffective. You can't tell me that I can't put that scene with these two characters on page 45. Of course I can. The question is that going to be the most effective choice for the story journey we're taking the audience on? And so we do the hero's journey. We do the three-act structure because it's the easiest way to teach this stuff, not because it's the most effective way to tell the story. So what we need to do, ultimately, I believe, in the screenwriting world is find better ways to tell more effective and more original stories. Think about it this way. If I want to build an independent film studio, which I do, to make eventually hundreds of films a year, like that is my grand ambition of like with production teams all around the world. Like I have this huge vision. If we made Hero's Journey and Three Act Structure Stories, we use the same formula for every film, how quick is the audience going to go, hang on, I'm seeing the same movie here over and over again, right? We're going to recognize the unoriginality of it. So we need originality. We tell story. TV is not told in a 3X structure story, but it still works. It's told in a 4X structure story. Why does that work?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Because it's using the same setup payoff dynamics in different overlapping ways, right? So if you have three storylines in a TV show, you have your setup payoff arc in the one storyline, setup payoff arc in another storyline, you can mix and match so that you're always leaving sort of those cliffhanger hooks and the elements that are going to keep that audience coming through and wanting to know what happens next in your story. So because a movie is a self-sustained, encompassed in one storytelling session, because of that, we need it to be self-contained, right? We need to, and so as a result, when we analyze existing stories, we're thinking of it in terms of those story segments and that structure, that sort of formula. But I think the formula hurts us more than it helps us. And so my approach to it is that process-based approach where we're going to take everyone through that process of formulating ideas, that process of getting it on the page, that process of going through your whole story systematically, big picture, whole story, act level, scene level, dialogue level, experience level. We're going to go through that and see how all the details affect all the other layers of it so that we make sure it's exactly the story we want to tell at the end of it. Like going through the process, I think, is stronger than imposing some story type on your idea. You might have a great idea and go, okay, well, now I have to figure out where my inciting incident is in plot point one. And so that's going to lead, and it's going to shape your idea in a way that might not be the most effective way to tell your story idea. So
I want to ask you a question in regards
you wound
to,
me up.
I get that. I want to ask you a question in regards to story structure, because
yes,
I know a lot of, you know, I've spoken to a lot of screenwriters, and
I know you have.
and a lot of them at the high levels, you know, even off the record, sometimes I talk to them off. I'm like, man, that structure of that movie seems similar to this film. And many of them quietly, I'm not going to say who, many of them quietly have said, yeah, because I used that structure as my template for my script. So I always like using Point Break. Break. I mean, anybody who watches Fast and Furious, it's Point Break with cars. It's
right.
The same.
For sure. For
exact sure. Story. Well, I mean, they didn't even try to change it. Exactly. It was so structurally the same, even characters the same. But what do you think of going into some of your favorite movies? So like, let's say you have a story idea, like, okay, I have a detective story. Well, let's go to Knives Out, or let's go to, you know, some old Sherlock Holmes structures or whatever, you know, detective stories there are, and using those stories as that structure template to kind of lay out a template that works with the kind of story you're trying to do.
I think that's totally fine. I think that's acceptable. I don't see any reason why not to do that. So some of those things are going to work. Look, the reason the 3X structure and Hero's Journey are these archetypes that keep getting taught over and over again is because they do work. They work exceptionally well for those kinds of stories. What I'm saying is that if you're just because you have an idea doesn't mean that you want to fit into the same archetype. Correct. If you do, use it. I teach it. I teach 3X structure. I teach bits and pieces of Hero's Journeys. Like, you need to know the stuff for one thing. It's the common language of the film industry. So it's like you need to be able to speak that stuff with some degree of intelligence. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that should limit the creative choices that we make, right? So, and it doesn't mean that a script or story is wrong if we're not telling it according to that structure. So as a, if you're a new writer, you're just starting out, by all means, impose an existing structure over your current idea, see what it does to your idea, see if it makes it work and how it makes it work and why those dynamics are what they are. At the end of the day, if you go back to setup and payoff, look, my backing up a little bit, and probably since we last spoke, I've come to deeply believe that all story is about change. It's not necessarily about the hero changing, but it's about something changes. If nothing changes in your story, it's going to be boring as sin and it's not really going to engage an audience. If because we are so enamored of the hero driven story of that, the all that, we tend to only focus, and maybe executives tend to typically focus on the hero's change, that character arc. But that's a specific type of story and not necessarily the most interesting take on it. Sometimes you want your character to not change. You want the other characters in the story to make a change, or the place can change, or some technology thing can, like, it's in seeing the change that we extract the meaning from a story. That's how stories give us meaning, is by what changed and how and why.
So I know, because a lot of people listening might think like, well, heroes or the, you know, heroes always change. I'm like, no, they don't at all. Absolutely not.
No, not at all.
James Bond until Casino Royale.
Exactly.
Never moved.
But if you had genuine character change, you wouldn't have TV shows either, because you can't have a character week to week with the same comic foibles, for example, a sitcom or something. If they were making a change each week, like
Sam Malone is Sam Malone.
Exactly.
He might make a change from the beginning of the series to the end of the series, and maybe. It may be slight. I mean, right. You're doing something like they did with Breaking Bad, which absolutely
that
was.
Well, changing. That is a change for sure, and that's, but designed. They knew going into it that was exactly. You're
they
right.
They knew where
exactly.
they were going to use Mr. Chips into Scarface. Like that's
exactly.
That's thing. But you look at something like Indiana Jones, and I was just thinking as we were talking, I'm like, all right. Indy doesn't really change a whole hell of a lot. But the people around him do. So like in Temple of Doom, Kate Capshaw's character absolutely changes. Like she went from this actress who was very prissy and oh my God, the jungle, to a badass at the end of the whole thing. And even Short Round changes to a certain extent. But Indy is kind of the James Bond. Like he kind of doesn't change greatly.
And so can you imagine like script notes on that of like, well, we need to see Indy like grow and evolve as a character because the three act structure tells us that, but you know what I mean? Like
that's not the story that they're trying to tell. That's what
exactly. And so the problem becomes that then we take this stuff that we've all been taught or that we've studied or whatever, and we impose it upon an idea and possibly take out the most interesting or nuanced or
correct
audience grabbing element of that, because we're looking at it through a very specific lens that this industry has imposed upon it. And I'm just trying to push back on that a little bit and say, I don't think that's right. I think it's the setup payoff dynamic underneath it, that if you get the setup payoff dynamic correct, where the things at the beginning, you can't set something up and then not pay it off, because then you're right. Going to feel empty or there's going to be holes in the story. It's just going to feel wrong some way. And you can't have this big payoff without first setting it up or it emotionally doesn't mean anything to us and doesn't hit us right. So you're not going to be able to, if a character or a scene or situation doesn't change over time, we're not going to take much away from that. And so that's sort of the approach that I go in with is that that's our sort of guiding light.
So, and I'm going to go back to Shawshank for a second. Imagine that there is no Red.
Exactly.
Imagine that they bring Red and Andy's character into the one Andy character, let's say. And let's say Andy.
I'm not sure you could, but carry on.
No, I'm just throwing this out there. To prove your point. So let's say we throw these two characters together and we follow Andy and he's hopeless at the beginning. And at the end, through maybe another character outside of him, teaching him hope. But the perspective of the whole story is Andy's. It is not somebody else watching Andy. It's Andy. You are with Andy. You feel his pain. You're in that room with the ladies, or whatever they call them, that did all mm-hmm. that stuff to him. All of that stuff. And you're following through the whole journey. And they might still be able to hold off the payoff, which if you haven't seen Shawshank, spoiler alert, exactly. When he escapes, maybe you hold all that stuff off. Let's say we build that story. It's still it's a good story, but it's not nearly as powerful as the way it was written.
And this is kind of what I get at is that story could still be a great story. Yeah. But because you're telling it, you would be telling it from a different angle. The message, the point, the purpose, the theme, in some cases, the sort of big picture idea is different.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And so the takeaway is going to feel different. The audience is going to feel different about the movie. All of those things come from those story choices that you're making. And so so you have to understand, like, as a writer, at least, filmmakers too, you have to really understand that the choices that you make story structurally, the choices that you make with the character arc, the choices that you, the decisions that you make about what that, whatever that change is going to be, are the thing that give the audience the feeling that they take away from your film. It's right. What it all is about, ultimately. And little details can change the entire picture and scope and meaning and message, all of it, right? So it's all interconnected. Every little piece is intertwined. And that's the big challenge of it, because you change a scene over here and suddenly, well, this doesn't really set it up properly. And well, now how do I fix that now? And it's like, that's the challenge of the job.
And do you know that I think originally Indiana Jones came to be because Spielberg wanted to do a Bond film?
Really? I didn't know.
I think the story goes that, and please in the comments let me know if I'm wrong, but I hear the legend is that he wanted to direct a Bond movie and couldn't, for whatever reason, didn't work out. And he was on the beach with George, Mr. Lucas, mm-hmm. and they said, hey, he goes, oh, I have something better for you. I've been thinking about this Indiana thing, or this archaeologist. And he's like, oh, what? So it makes sense that they would construct Indiana very similarly to James Bond, because Indiana just goes on adventures and arguably doesn't change much. If you had a character like Indiana Jones that changes from point A to point B, like let's say like a Red did in Shawshank, it's just not the same story. It's just not.
It's not. If you had Indiana Jones going through some personal transformation, it becomes about his transformation, not right. about the pure escapism, adventurism Adventure. That the movie's about. And so because they wanted to make a sort of serial adventure story,
those stories
that has to go front and center. And so right. the change over time becomes the you know, opening up the Nazis opening, getting the thing, so you're seeing that change over time rather than the character change over time, and that's right. what drives the point, the purpose, the meaning, the message, all that,
right? And Flash Gordon and those kind of serials that they're based on,
sure.
they don't change, they you know,
you wouldn't want them to.
Superman didn't change.
You don't want Superman to change. He's super freaking man.
He's like, you're done. Like, it's exactly. you know, and then later on you have to do other things, but to make those stories more interesting. All right, so Jeff, listen, all right, so I have an idea. Yeah. I want to write a screenplay fast. Give me mm-hmm. the bullet points of how I can write that idea, get at least that first draft out onto the page quickly.
So there's a couple things. So I do have a whole thing that I do at the beginning. It's actually currently a part. I added it as a tool to the setup phase of my system, where it's really all about what I call a fast draft. And it's all about getting your ideas into draft. Some people would refer to it as a sketch draft or a vomit draft or like that kind of a thing. But mine's a little bit more targeted in that you're thinking and plan. It's not just sit down and start typing. It's a brain dump kind of thing. So the first thing that I would do is I would say, take all the ideas that you have in your head and write one idea on an index card. And you stack up all these, you get all the ideas out of your head and onto individual index cards. Then you're going to scatter these around, put them up on a wall, whatever, and just absorb them and see what connections you might see. And then from that, figure out who's the driver of the story, figure out what the goal would be, figure out what the obstacle is going to be, start to see some of the thematic things within that stuff. Give yourself sort of a wireframe of where you're going from. What's the state A? What's the beginning state of the character or whatever it is that's going to change in your story? What's the state B? Figure out what that change is going to be. Change does not happen on a dime. Change happens incrementally. So a story is about the incremental change. The plot points, the twists and turns of your story are those incremental change points. So when you think about whatever's going to change, put it up on a wall, see how it sort of sketches out. Think about that and think about what needs to incrementally change for this to be a believable, plausible change. Then think about what are those scenes that you've mapped out on your index cards, whatever. Figure out what are the scene elements that could cause or correlate to those things. And just put sort of a general framework together of what that story might be. When you're outlining or you're putting your project together, you're getting your sketch together, the stuff that you do, what we do in detail in the focus phase, is it's not about finalizing your story. Writing is a process of discovery. Always remember that. Writing is a process of discovery. You will never have your story before you write it. You can flesh it out. You can say, this is what I think my story is going to be. And then you're going to write that story. But then when you see that story on the page, it's going to be different to what you thought it was going to be. It's not going to be as good. You're going to have new ideas that came up in the writing of it. And this brain that has a creative subconscious that spits ideas out to us. Why does that happen? Because your brain is always working in the background, piecing things together, finding connections, seeing themes. And you don't, it's like when you're driving a car, you don't think about every twist and turn you make on the journey. You can get from point A to point B and go, I don't even remember driving that distance. Your creative subconscious, that subconscious is just steering on autopilot. So your brain can go off in different directions. It's what it's designed to do. So we want to capture that. We want to let our creative subconscious out. And that happens when we simply blast stuff onto the page and then see what's there. So when you're planning, when you've got this, put it on a wall, spread it out on the tape, on the floor in front of you, whatever it is, find those connections, find those things, start wireframing the thing. Then what you want to do is you want to blast a draft out to specific road markers. So give yourself every five pages or something like that, right? Just simply write to the next five pages. Don't worry about the whole thing. Just worry about getting to the next five pages because you want to have a draft. Until you have a draft, you don't even know the possibility of where your story could go. Once you have that draft, that's when you're going to look at it and you're going to analyze it and you're going to think about it from the different levels and layers of your story. There's the big picture. What's the idea that you're trying to get across? There's the whole story, which is like, how am I expressing that big picture idea, the actual story? Then there's the acts, those like major components that comprise that story. Then there's the scenes, the blocks of action that comprise those acts that make up that whole story. Then there's the dialogue level, which is like a window to the characters and the story. So we understand sort of the machinations that are happening behind the story. And then there's the individual beats of your story. So if you want to get stuff written quickly, get your ideas out of your head. Get them onto index cards, flesh them out, give yourself road markers, and then blast out a draft. See what you've got and then improve that.
I'm exhausted.
Oh my God. Can you tell that I live and breathe this stuff every day and have done for 25 years?
That's amazing. Jeff, I know I could keep talking to you for at least another 4 or 5 hours. I probably would
keep talking your ear off for all that time. You'd be like, just make him stop.
But I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
Today, my advice for a screenwriter would be think local. Because I really believe that the biggest opportunities that we have today to launch a career are local. There are people in your neighborhood, wherever you live in the world, that have the capacity to make movies and probably want to. And so if you're wanting to be a writer, write for those people. If you imagine Steven Spielberg or George Lucas or whatever, like, how did they become so close? They grew up together. Like, they went through the film school. They were like, they were emerging talent before they were big names together. So, Right. Of course, they're going to work together, like, not necessarily them, but people at that level. Find your own people at your own level, locally, within your own town, within your own city.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You can make movies today. Get good at those skills. Develop those skills locally. So then you have showpiece. Then you have something that you can take to the studios or the bigger levels that you want to reach out to. And you're not coming with a script in your hand that they don't want to read because they don't know who you are. Instead, you're coming with an indie film that the first 5 minutes goes, wow, this is amazing. Oh, and what? You won which festivals? Oh, and so, like, suddenly this is somebody to pay attention to. And then they like this little indie film and they go, what else have you got? I've got my big tentpole project that Alex told me not to write, right? Like, that would be my advice, is think local, because that's going to be your key to global domination.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I remember my answer last time, but I'm going to give you a different answer this time. This time it is let it go.
Let go.
Oh, exactly. No, don't get me started.
I'm not going to start singing.
You have an idea of where you're trying to get. And because you have an idea of where you're trying to get, you can get fixated on that and it can blind you to what's right in front of you. And so when I say let it go, I don't mean let go of that goal, that passion. That is your fuel. That's your motivation. Let that push you. Let that drive you. But let go of the outcome. Let go of, I need it to look this way or I'm a failure. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a movie star. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, I was like, yeah, you know what? I'm not the leading man. I'm the leading man's best friend. Like, that's just my type, right? So I'm probably not going to be the star. So if I hold on to that impossible thing, maybe it's possible. Maybe I could have achieved it. But what would I miss along the way because I'm so stuck on that one idea? If you can let that go, I think you open yourself up to a world of possibility. And today, we live in a world of possibility. I know that in the film industry, there's this general sense of it's impossible. If you can find anything you love in the world to do, go do that instead. Like, I hate that advice. I hate that people say that. No, you can do this. We have more opportunity today than we've ever had ever. There are no gatekeepers anymore. You can go make your own stuff. If there's no gatekeepers anymore, the quality is where it all comes from. What are you capable of doing? Develop those skills and get there. So let go of those preconceived ideas. Wow, man, I'm on a roll.
God, and last question, sir.
Shut up, Jeff.
Three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, man, I knew you were going to ask me this, and I hate this question.
I know.
I'm always going
to
struggle.
Three that come to your mind today.
I want to find a good sci-fi. I love Inception. I know these are all going to be cliche, but I love Inception. I love the mystery. Sanity. I'll tell you what, another one that I really like is called Time Crimes. Have you seen that one?
Time Crimes.
Spanish film. Fantastic. If you like time travel, Time Crimes, man. Mark my words, you're going to like it. It's a great little film. And then since we'll just keep it all sci-fi, Primer. I love Primer. Primer is not something that you would look at and go, that's a well-written film, because it's not about the writing. It's about the end film. And it's cool. I love brain teasers and I love puzzles and stuff like that. So I lean towards sci-fi just because it's a fantastic. I'm a possibilities person and I like to think through like where we're going and all that kind of stuff. And brain puzzles and stuff. I think we have to exercise this thing to get us where we're trying to go. And I love sci-fi for that reason. So
that's awesome, man. And where can people find out more about you and your work and all the stuff that you're doing?
I have probably a half a dozen places you can find me, but I'll keep it to one, which I'll just say Fast Screenplay. Because if you if nothing else, join me on the Fast Screenplay free newsletter. I call it daily-ish, daily prompt. I used to do a daily prompt thing on YouTube where it was like, here's a little prompt to get you writing today. And so I've started doing that in email, and I don't do daily because I got a lot going on, but it's daily-ish and it'll keep you posted with all the various things that I have. And I've got some really cool things coming up. So
Jeff, it has been a pleasure and an honor, sir, having you back on the show. Thank you for the hard work that you do for screenwriters around the world, sir. I appreciate you, man. Thank you. And keep the hustle going, brother. I appreciate you.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for indulging me. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Alex. I love what you do. Keep doing what you're doing as well.
I want to thank Jeff so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Jeff. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/604. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.